you know, looking through a, you know, screen and whatever he's looking through, as if he was on board the Progress cargo vehicle, trying to dock it manually, and something went wrong, and Progress went up and hit the solar array, and then hit the Cavant, I think it was called the Cavant. They had to suspect the module, the Cavant module, I think it was the Cavant one that got, wound up with a hole in it, and eventually they just closed that off permanently and never went in there again. That's probably the one you're thinking about. I don't think anything's hit the space station that large, of course. And they have all kinds of procedures now. When spacecraft go up to the space station, they stay, you know, like 10 miles out, and then they stay 5 miles out, mile out, half mile out, 600 feet out. Before they, you know, and each time they go through this whole check type of thing. And if there's any kind of a problem, especially, you know, something really bad, even the automatic ones would abort. They would abort, leave the space station area. So, in fact, that happened on the last Dragon. Got close, and all of a sudden, it got bad telemetry from the space station, like the space station was backwards or something. And the computers automatically aborted the Dragon, so they held off, I think it was a day before they brought the Dragon in for berthing to the space station.
Because of that accident, I'm guessing they don't schedule any more of these practice docking maneuvers to dock once safely. I bet everybody keeps their fingers crossed and happy that turns out right. So when it comes to practicing, I think that should be done with a ground simulator, not with space hardware, because the risk is awfully high, as I see it. So you're saying they do practice once a month what to do in the case of a leak. And has anyone ever stated what is the smallest object that potentially could be in orbit that could give them a risk? What's the smallest object that they can track? And I'll bet you that smallest object is big enough to create a hole on a direct impact that could be troublesome. Of you, Paul, KQRIW.
I think NORAD's at 10 centimeters. It's the smallest that they could track. What's that, about 4 inches? So I would imagine if you get hit with anything, even 1 inch, you know, imagine a 1 inch nut coming off, a 1 inch bolt hitting the space station. Go right through it, it's, you know, 17,000 miles per hour. But they got to worry about meteorites, and meteoroids, and meteoroid shields all over the place. I think they're always getting hit with something. So, I said about once a year. I think it's averages around once a year that they'd have to go to the Soyuz spacecraft because there is something nearby. That they detect that's nearby the space, coming near the space station. Whether they practice or not, I guess they probably practice on a regular basis. Sure. I don't know. Back to you, Dick, WSY.
4 centimeters, or 4 inches, whichever you said. In either case, that's an awfully big object. That can make an extremely big hole with those velocities. Wow. Now, we can talk about the probability. Maybe this is a once-per-100-year event. But you know, like one of those once-per-100-year events alike, you can predict something is going to be once-per-100 years, like whether or not you're going to get a failure at a nuclear power station. Well, we burned up that 100-year event on 3 or 4 occasions already. So, in the case of a nuclear power station, the estimation of how often you're going to get a major event, we now know in many cases they're very optimistic. In the case of that crash on the Mir, they probably never really did a complete report and study. But if I did, I imagine there's a small chance that it wasn't equipment failure, that it could have been pilot error. Is that possible, Paul?
I've seen articles that even if they had a show on TV, and naturally they're going to blame the cosmonaut that was handling it, you know. But, you know, he's only being directed to do something that he's been so, you know, trained for, and it's not right. It's not right, you know. I mean, you know, it's not like the guy fell asleep at the wheel. You know, whatever system that they were using, like you said, should have figured out earlier and simulated before this guy ever tried it. Maybe they did try it and simulate it. You know, they might not have seen something. And the same for launches. You know, I just read recently that all these launches that are planning to go to the space station by SpaceX and Boeing with people on board, they're more or less requiring, I think it was 275 one-to-one odds on whether or not you could have a situation where the crew could be lost. So that's why they need all these escape systems. It has to be able to escape a booster from the second they get on board and get ready to fly all the way to orbit, and then the docking of the spacecraft to the space station or wherever they might be going. There's future space stations that are planned. Again, not being funded yet, but there's future ones out there. And I think it's 1 to 200.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
For the development of a manned spacecraft. Give you an idea, by the time the shuttle was over, it was, I think, 1 out of 63 possibility. In other words, we lost two space shuttles out of 135 launches back today.
So, 1 out of 63 is what they actually experienced. But before that, the prediction was a much higher number, wasn't it? 1 per 100 and something up all was the predicted failure rate.
I would imagine. I don't remember the year. Yeah, I know it was higher. I remember when the shuttle was being proposed. They thought they would be taking off an average of once every 2 weeks, you know, with 4 shuttles in the fleet. And that never happened. Turnaround time was too long. And now SpaceX is trying to beat that. You know, they have that booster that just went up, you know, for a second time and landed successfully on the barge, and they bought that back already. They want to be able to do that over and over quickly. That went up a year ago, and now here it is a year later, and it finally went up the second time, first time it's ever been done. They looked at it with a fine-tooth comb before they did it, and they said they spent about 4 months of actual work on that booster. His goal is to bring it down to 24 hours. I'm surprised he even said that. I don't ever see that happening.
In the case of the space shuttle, where they thought they're going to send up one every couple of weeks, they sort of believe that all they'd have to do is clean out the living quarters, put in new consumables, load in new fuel, and fly it again. In reality, I think the thermal tiles, I vaguely remember they had to do an awful lot of work restoring thermal tiles on each landing. Isn't that true, Paul? In other words, the method by which the thermal tiles were attached turned out to be very troublesome, as I remember. WKQLIW.
Yeah, I think they had like 28,000 tiles or something. That was the biggest problem. And then they had to essentially rebuild those engines, you know, take a lot of stuff apart, put new stuff in, and a lot of stuff had to be redone. They had problems, and the tiles, of course, were the main problem. And they're very light. I've held one in my hand, and it's like a big piece of styrofoam, and it weighs about as much. And they got these things glued to the tile, coming in at 17,500 miles an hour. Not crazy about the design, but I know it worked. Their attachment system, I think, was the problem. Like you said, now the newer designs on these heat shields that they have for the new vehicles are much more improved. They're actually, some of them are planned on, they're going to plan on reusing some of those heat shields. Not on Orion with NASA, but, you know, with SpaceX. They call it a PICA, P-I-C-A, heat shield. They think they could reuse this thing 10 times. That would be a big improvement over styrofoam tiles. That's what they were like.
The early shuttles had a zillion, I think it's at 18,000, individual square tiles. And I'm guessing they came up with a tool where after a landing you could grab each one of the tiles and pull on it to make sure that they were well attached. And I think the zillions of tiles eventually became much bigger heat blankets, which I think were easier to check on and hold down. I think there was a layer of Nomex with something like celastic adhesive that held down each one of the tiles. Did they ever clearly define what was the failure mechanism by which the tile attachment wasn't good enough? Because darn many tiles had to be replaced after each mission. Did they ever publish a report on that, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
I know they got better at it over time, but, you know, the first shuttle that came back was, I don't know, something like 30 different tiles missing. And Bob Crippen couldn't believe it when he looked at it. You know, I mean, he's happy with the spacecraft, but this tile thing. Bob Crippen was the first pilot. He was co-pilot. John Young was pilot. So, you know, they did get better at it. You're talking about the blankets on the side. You know, the upper part of the vehicle had white tiles that were replaced with these blankets. But the bottom part never changed. Under the body, the fuselage and the wings, they all had tiles, that blackish-looking tiles. Were never changed. They used that same tile system. That was never replaced with a blanket type of thing. Back to you.
Now, if on the early missions a significant number of the tiles ended up missing, I see the possibility that if enough tiles in one location fall off, and now you've got this great big gaping hole, and the wind can get in there and start peeling off the rest of the tiles like dominoes. Did anybody ever worry about that possible failure mechanism, Paul, K2RAW?
Yeah, they did, and but it never happened. They'd lose one here, they'd lose one there. Very strange. They're very thick. Got to be about, I'd say about 2.5 inches thick. 2.25 inches, some places 2 inches. And that was the other thing. There was no rhyme or reason. I mean, these were individual tiles. I think it was like 28,000 on the early shuttles, if I'm not mistaken. That number might be wrong, I'll have to check, but each one was cataloged. So that made replacement tiles expensive. I don't know, it seemed to work. You could take the thing, put a blowtorch to it, and touch the other side, and you don't even feel it being hot on the opposite side. They thought it was a great thing.
Did they invent a tool by which they could tug on each tile to make sure it was well attached before the next launch? Paul, go ahead.
That rings a bell. I remember hearing that. But I can't say for sure. But I know they did test every single tile. This is all time consuming. But there were so many things that had to be done, you know. Tires and wheels, they would blow out. You know, they only used the tires once. After it landed, those tires were changed out. That was it. That was another thing. Those things were supposed to be reusable. A couple of the shuttle missions, the tires blew out entirely.
Yeah, that I never remember hearing, Paul. So in other words, you change the tires on every single flight. So sometimes the tire is used for the very first time during a landing, and each one of those landings looks like they were very well done, nice and soft. So you're telling me there were cases where a tire blew out on a landing. Wow. I don't remember ever seeing on any of the return movies, Paul. Go ahead, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'll have to find the one that they talk about. It's pretty dramatic. But, they were really beat up after every single landing. So you had this, I guess, 250,000 pound plane coming down, 200,000 pounds or more, coming down at 100 miles per hour on a steep dive. But they always came in very smoothly. You know, it didn't look like there was going to be any damage to the tires, but every flight they changed them out. And they knew it was going to be a problem when they were testing these things. You know, they used to take the shuttle and put it on top of the 747, let it loose, and then the shuttle would come down and land in the White Sands, New Mexico. They did that many times. They saw tire damage there, so they knew they were in for trouble. These were not going to be reusable tires.
In the one case you know about where a tire blew out and you saw the movie, did the aircraft do any zigzag going down the runway after that tire blew up, Paul? K2RIW?
No, it didn't. You had sets of tires, you know. You had them on the port and starboard side, you know. You had a couple of sets of tires there, same on the other side, same with the front. It wasn't like there was one tire on the front. Like everything NASA does, they were redundant.
So you had wheels on the port side, wheels on the starboard side, tires. Are we talking about like four or six tires on each side, and just one of those tires blew? Is that approximately what happened to Paul Grant?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was one of the ones in the rear, but don't think it was the one in the front. Might have been, but you know, the rear's touched first, and then the front comes down.
By the time the front comes down, you're already slowed down an awful lot, so that's a much more soft landing for a bunch of reasons, as I see it. And each engine had to be thoroughly refurbished after each flight. What was wearing out in those engines, Paul, K2RIW?
I don't remember. They change out the... I would imagine they change out the impellers. I know they had problems with them. You know, in the beginning they changed out a lot of things, and I guess as time went on they turned out, you know, changed less. But turbo pumps were always, I think, problematic. Now they saved a lot of them, you know. I mean, they flew back to 16 left from shuttle flights. There's quite a few of them that actually went up and came back, and they removed the engine from the orbiters. And they're actually going to reuse these. They're called RS-25 engines, so that's the shuttle engine. And some of these are going to be put on the bottom of the new SLS Space Launch System. You're going to have four on the bottom, four shuttle engines. You remember, the shuttle had three RS-25 engines. The new rocket's going to have four. So, yeah, some of them are still in good shape, and they're going to use them. They're going to put out more power instead of, 80 or 90% efficient power. They're going to go out 109% over the rated amount, because they're not going to save them next time. They're going to throw them in the drink. They're not coming back home. So they're just going to send it to the maximum capability at 109%. That's what they're going to be using, RS-25 shuttle engines.
What's the approximate thrust of an RS-25 engine, Paul?
550,000 pounds each. So that gives you an idea. The shuttle had, you know, 1.5 million on that. And then you had 3 million on one solid, 3 million on the other. I think it was, correction, 2.5. So that was 5 roughly, by the time it took off, I think it was 5.5 million pounds of thrust on the shuttle. They added up something like that. Now with the other ones, you're going to have four of these, so four engines, so that's roughly 2 million on the new Space Launch System, and then 3.5 million on each booster, so that's 7, 8, 9, yeah, that's how they get the 9.5 million pounds of thrust for the new Space Launch System.
Yeah, I do remember astronaut Owen Garriott, or one of the others, talking to students in school from space, and he said when the shuttle takes off, I think he said it's a little over 4 million pounds of mass with 6.5 million pounds of total thrust. If each one of those RP-25s is 1.5 million, rough number, so that's 3.5 million each. So 1.5 million total from the liquid rocket engines. And that means you need something like almost 2.5 million on each solid rocket booster, assuming it doesn't blow a gasket. There's a pun there somewhere. It's amazing how many times the solid rocket boosters came back home, and when they were refurbished, you saw blowout holes in the gasket, and they just ignored that until that super cold morning with the one that failed in 1985, I think it was 86. I can't think of the name of it. OU Ball, KQIW. Challenger.
Yeah, that's right. And the one that came back from space was Columbia. Burnt up. The new next generation launch system by Orbital ATK, well, they changed their name, you know. But they're the ones that built the original solid boosters for the shuttle. And now they're building the new solid boosters for the SLS system. Give you an idea, the shuttle had four segments, that one on top of the other. And then they had the O-rings in between. The O-ring is one of the things that blew out. So the four segmented boosters. Now, the new one is one more, so it's five. So it's more power for a longer period of time on the new SLS systems. But again, made by Orbital ATK. Orbital ATK is also making the next generation launch system that I talked about earlier. And instead of having the segmented boosters, now they're going to have one long booster made out of carbon composite material. They've already built one. Now they're sending it through its test. You know, they're going to do everything to it, try to break it, but it's going to be different. It's going to be lighter, and that'll be on the next generation launch system. I'd like to see that implemented on the SLS system, eventually, the space launch system. Back to you.
I seem to remember the original solid rocket boosters were built by Morton Thiokol. Is Morton Thiokol no longer involved in building solid rocket boosters for these modern-day spacecraft?
Yeah, Morton sold the message that bought up by Thiokol, so they called Morton Thiokol out of Utah, Promontory, Utah, where they still test these things. And that's where they were built. Now, what happened is they became Orbital Science. So no more one Thiokol. It became Orbital Science. Orbital Science still doing the booster work out there for the SLS system. They were building the Antares rocket here on the East Coast, down in Virginia. And a lot of other work. I mean, they've been around forever. But now, in the last couple of years, they merged with ATK. So now they call it Orbital ATK. So Orbital ATK is, it would be the descendant of Morton Salt or Morton Thiokol. So that's why they're primarily involved with solid boosters and things like that. But Antares is not a solid booster. It's kerosene. Back to you.
So a change in the management, change in the title, change in the chain of command. This was TICnet number 1646. That was base report number 246. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. See you next week. Bye-bye for now. Over here to tie the ribbons on a pole. K2RIW, clear but listening.
Okay, very good. Time was fast when you're having fun, and it was 12. 73, guys, we'll be back next week, hopefully, and see what's happening in the technology world. 73, WS2N3.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system. Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
N2EO. This is N2MB Mobile.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30, WQVL repeater system.
gradually get back to normal. I've been building a multimeter kit by the company called Elenco, E-L-E-N-C-O, and I came across a stumbling block. I had a problem with an overloaded circuit. So I called the company, and they sent me some new parts for free. So I want to get back into that. That was really nice of them.
Andy, I'm not copying you. Maybe you want to go over to the Western input? I don't know. You know, I also have a hearing problem, so I have to see a place called Hear USA. It was recommended to me. I'm going to go over there. I got to make an appointment, go over there. I was already told I probably need two hearing aids, so it's partially you and partially me.
On the Western input. I'm on Comac Road. Actually, Sacramento Coast Parkway. Signal still bad?
Nope. I can see you on the Eastern input. By the tone, that time it was fine. Anyway, at 9 o'clock, I'm calling up that neurologist to get more modern medications. Patty suggests.
I'm sorry, I am on the Eastern input. I had just changed a moment ago. You hear me okay?
You're fine.
We picked up for our daughter some really nice digital hearing aids from a company called Widex. W-I-D-E-X. She wears what's called an M-Dex around her neck, and she can program it to block out surrounding noises. She could focus in front or back or on people that she's having a direct conversation with. And they have Bluetooth. You can hook up your phone and your TV to it. They're pretty cool, but I think all the companies have that now.
Okay, we'll have to check. This was recommended to me by something called MLTC. That stands for the Managed Long-Term Care from North Shore Hospital. So I have them already. So it won't cost me anything. It'll be covered.
That's really good. Very good. Fortunate. I would wonder what kind of hearing aids they would give you, though. They're the analog kind, and the new digital ones are really pretty impressive.
I have no idea. I gotta call them and find out. But the woman who was in charge of MLTC told me about them. I don't know what she said. The company they use is Hear USA. So I gotta get the information from her. She's a social worker in charge of the MLCT program at Outpatient North Shore Hospital. Here you go, Andy.
Yeah, still here. Got on the town bypass after the parkway. And just getting in position with these cars moving around.
Hi, Andy. Very good. How far out do you go? Where are you?
I'm coming into Hop Hog now, but I go to East Pawtucket, so I'm halfway through my trip right now. I'm near the memorial. And, there's a state office building over here.
Okay, Andy. Well, we all know technology has advanced a tremendous amount. Do you know hearing aids have to have, like, earbuds, and you carry the big, a big box that have the tubes in it, the batteries for the hearing aid. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that.
My father-in-law had a pretty big set of hearing aids. Since he was a vet, the VA center paid for them. He got them for nothing. But I know they had big batteries and they were pretty big housings, but they're pretty small now because they're digitized. They don't need all that power behind them, so the housing is a lot smaller. They use a lot smaller batteries, but there's a lot less energy consumption.
That's right. Everything is gone digital today. That's great. Look at my Kinect systems on TMR. They never had something like that before. If they tried to make it years ago, it would take up the whole room.
What's amazing to me is these integrated chips. How they can make this stuff so incredibly small. Certainly don't have anybody sitting there with a soldering gun putting them together.
Absolutely. When I lived in Whitestone, Andy, people would come in because I had a small business doing what Andy does and what Hal does, X-radios. And I remember these surface-mounted chips. I had a way of getting them up and putting in new chips. It took a while, but I never messed up the circuit boards. You gotta be very careful.
This is KD2ESY. Yep, 347 eastbound. Beautiful. Gorgeous day. Wish we could work outside.
Because maybe I'd like to eat breakfast on my patio.
So quiet out here. The radio community must just shut down during a holiday. This is Easter week, I believe. We don't celebrate Easter anymore. Easter really doesn't make much sense. There's nothing to do with the Catholic Church anyway. Or any other church. Very interesting holiday.
That's all comment, but how was I asking him? How was the temperature out there? I haven't been out yet. I want to eat breakfast on the patio.
Well, you're definitely going to want to have at least a light jacket on. It's 53 degrees. And it's nice. Crystal clear sky. Crisp morning. Did you see the rainbow the other day? After that rain we had come through, there was this beautiful double rainbow. We got some pictures in the backyard. We came back from funeral, sat down at the kitchen table, looked out the window, and it was a gorgeous, gorgeous rainbow.
Okay, and the end to real. No, I did not. I wish I had. You don't get them too often.
Saw this program on TV, probably Discover or something like that. Rainbows are actually complete circles. And if you were high enough in the air, like to float up in the air above your house or wherever, mountain, you would see that the rainbows are in a complete circle, but because of our location, you usually only see the top part.
That's interesting. How about that song, you know, the rainbow. What was that? What movie am I thinking about?
I don't know. You got me. Sounds like you're drifting off there.
No, I pulled away from the light. I'm good. I'm up. I'm still a little groggy, but I'm up. I take some medication to sleep. It's not a sleeping pill, just something to relax me. You ever hear of trazodone?
Yes.
Wonder what you think of it. I take a 150 milligram pill before I go to sleep, and I'm more anxiously.
Gotta be careful of some of that stuff. That can be pretty strong.
I have you heard anything, Pete?
Enjoy your breakfast, and don't forget, don't wake Patty until after 9.
All right, Andy, listen, have a good day. KD2ESY, M2EO.
7-3, Rich. KD2ESY, clear.
Breakfast, and it's warming up on the patio.
It's getting up there. Where I am, it's in the high 50s. Now, I understand it's supposed to get into, depending on where you are, somewhere into the 60s and or around 70. So it should be pretty pleasant.
And that's very nice. I was telling one of the other guys, my birthday is April 21st. And I asked Patty. Copy, Steve. Somebody's playing games.
No, I didn't even mention that your birthday was later in the month.
Yes, we're going to go out for it.
I'm sorry, say again?
Yes, we're going to go out. There's a place right here called Al Smoker.
Oh, okay. What kind of food?
I don't know everything. I saw them on the internet and was right a few blocks away. They got smoked chicken, smoked ribs, all that kind of stuff.
That sounds interesting. Let me know how it is. I'd be kind of curious. I'm not into smoked food that much, although sometimes if it's made well, it's enjoyable. Let me make a quick phone call. Excuse me. I just realized I neglected doing something yesterday.
At 9 o'clock, I gotta do the same thing. I'll stand by until we go.
How about you be too ZS?
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
J0SJG monitoring via Echo.
Hello, Sonny. M2EO. Just want to say hello. I'm after Ron. I'm waiting for breakfast.
Roger that, QSL. Good morning. Yeah, I'm going to try to get out and do a little strolling around today. I feel a little better. So just stop by to say hello, and last night I enjoyed listening to the TechNet. It was pretty nice. Great job with the TechNet, by the way. So, all right, well, you have a great day. Enjoy your breakfast, and I'll probably catch you later. I'll just be here monitoring for a little bit while I get dressed and head out the door. So we'll talk later. N2EO, K0SJG. Have a good day.
Okay, Charlie. Yes, Patty will be down with breakfast in a few minutes. So, I'll talk to you later. K0SJG, M2EO.
Net tonight at 8:30, W2VL, repeater system.
This is K0 SK0 SKG, clearing the echo link. Thank you for the use of the repeater.
How you doing, Mike? What are you up to this morning? Grandson, 8 years old. He's off this week. My wife was over there watching him. I got to go to the gym after 2 weeks because we were busy at home with some construction work. A little grocery shopping. Now I'm heading home. Sounds good. How old is he?
19.
Say he's 8 years old, like mine. I was asking you, how old is the grandson?
Hello, Katie, doing MZ on 2 meter.
Yeah, that's what you said. You switched over to 440. I bet you didn't realize it.
All right, well, now I'm into the 2 meter. Anyways, how you doing? How's everything? Sometimes it's difficult on this radio.
Before you clear what's right, I was asking how old is your grandson?
Okay, my grandson, he's 6 years old. I'm sorry. You know, it's difficult to tell which channel you're on because it's a two-band radio, and it's hard to tell which one is active, if you know what I mean.
I know what you're saying. I do that sometimes. Anyway, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. It's a good day to get some fresh air. So we'll see. If I get any more fresh air today, back to you.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, it's going to be a nice day. I got some paint and some rust restorers so I can finish my barbecue project. I hope it'll get my parts in a few days. And like I was saying before, the Home Depot people were nice enough to give me 2 free kits. So I got some kind of like a little carry case kit. And I got another birdhouse kit. And they just gave them to me for free, so I got 2 birdhouses and a little carry case. Perfect project for my grandson, and I went and bought him his very first real tool, which is a 10-ounce claw hammer.
Gotta be careful with that, because you're not. Be careful with it. It's not a toy. It can really do some damage.
Well, believe me, I know what it is. I had my first hammer when I was about his age. And that's how you learn how to use them and what's right and what's wrong. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep it, like, on my tool bench. But whenever he needs to use it, he'll just come and get it from me. But it's going to have his name on it. That will be his hammer.
Well, that's very thoughtful for you. You're a good grandpa. And to that you say.
Thank you. I don't think you can use my stuff. My stuff is, you know, starting at 16 ounce and working up to 4 pounds if we're talking hammers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, my son has taken our granddaughter, his son, his daughter, she just turned 6, to Home Depot. I think he's taken my grandson as well, the 8-year-old, my daughter's son, to do those projects. That's a nice thing that they offer. There's no charge, right?
And then this guy was just talking to the guy in the tool bin, tool corral or whatever they call it over there. I said, yeah, you know, I'm looking for a little, like a small 10-ounce hammer for my grandson. Well, we ran out. He says, why? Well, I want to build a little project with him this weekend. So I'm going to build it. My wife's going to paint it with him. So I'll do the heavy construction, and my wife will do the painting and or protective coatings if we're going to use the vernacular.
Oh, look at this woman. She almost crashes. Now watch the way she's going. Well, that's a good thing to get involved like that. Something constructive, that's for sure.
You know, nothing for nothing. Kids, and I don't mean anything bad, but kids these days, we don't know what to do with their hands. They're so into their smartphones and whatnot, and when it comes down to taking 2 pieces of wood and nailing them together, they're lost.
suppose. I didn't have that growing up. No one taught me how to do all that. It was a lot of fun when I got, when we bought our house way back when. Quick story. I was talking to some fellas at work about changing some parts in the toilet. They told me everything but to shut off the water supply. So here I start taking things apart and the water shooting out and hitting the ceiling, screaming to my wife, come in here, they're going to shut off something. And then I see the valve on the floor, or near the floor, underneath the water closet, the water, the shut-off valve. I didn't know anything about that.
There's a YouTube video for that.
N2PBN.
N2PBN. I think we've all done something like that when we were kids. But that's how you learn. That's how you learn. But hey, look, I just want to do something with my grandson this week. I was telling him to give me a hey, Rich, that, you know, we're going to take him to the Bronx Zoo Wednesday, because Wednesday is, you know, make your own donation day. So you pay for whatever you want to pay.
Hey, Rich. Yeah, kids today, like you said, they don't know how to do anything, but I'll be damned if there isn't a YouTube video out there for almost anything you could think of. Mike?
Oh, you got that part right. I use YouTube all the time to do something new or I don't know. Oh, yeah, no question about it. But nothing beats getting your hands dirty, and I don't have to tell you about that, Rich. KD2AMZ, probably Lou Epic, I couldn't catch a call. Go ahead, KD2AMZ.
And two as you see, it's Ron on this end. And I do, Rich. Yeah, my son has to use that, and I think with him when we go to his place in Pennsylvania, and he looks up different things, shows you how to fix plumbing and whatnot. Never did that myself, but that's also a handy thing to bring up when you don't know how to do it. And years ago, there was no such things. I used to have the books, buy books to teach you how to do things, home repair. The video was much more easy to follow, I would think. Over to Rich and then to Mike.
Hey, Ron, the videos are nice if the person that's doing the video is conscientious and explains everything and is very detail-oriented and it's exactly what you need to do. It's too many times you find a video that's a very generalized thing. It's like a generalization. Well, it's kind of like this, it's kind of like that. Especially when you get into, like, automotive stuff, you know, you have to be extremely diligent in making sure that the video that you're watching is exactly for your make, model, and year vehicle. Because you could get into all sorts of interesting little quandaries when you're sitting there with all these parts laying around your feet and you can't figure out how to put it all back together. Mike, N2PBN.
Oh, you got that part right, Rich. No question about it. No, but you still gotta, you know, just have the basics. You know, how does a tool feel in your hand? Like a person who uses their grip and their tools practically every day, you know what I'm talking about. You know, I just want to get them started at least. We get the flavor, because I don't even think they have, like, shop too much anymore in schools these days. Getting to MB.
2Z, you see, my last transmission almost, you talk about shop, that's a parochial school, then academic course in high school. There was no shop. There was no farm to teach me how to use your hammer and nails. That's how I fell into that problem after we bought our house, got married with the plumbing. So it's like, you learn as you go, or look at the book, or get somebody over, or what have you, so. Well, I survived, so I wish you guys a happy day, a good day. Enjoy the nice warm weather, and I'll listen out to PPN, you got it.
Hey, Ron, always a pleasure. I'm also about three blocks from home. I was telling Mike earlier I had to go pick up a couple of brass fittings over at the hardware store to repair my outside hose connections, my manifold. Because I had a freeze-up over the winter when we had that last cold snap. My son had forgotten to turn the water back off, and lo and behold, there you go. Split brass T. So, can't turn the water.